Our topic this evening is the Derech HaPsak, the halachic approach of Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman. For this series, we had some celebrities and we had non-celebrities. Rabbi Unterman is not really as known these days as he was back in his day, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, which is really a shame because he's a remarkable figure, as we're going to see. We're not going to be doing what I would think of as a full Derech HaPsak doctoral analysis of how he broke down problems and so on. What I want to do is I want to show some aspects of Rav Unterman because his psak, his approach to ruling and specifically to Jewish communal life, really to me epitomizes what a chief rabbi should do. His approach is one with a tremendous grasp of Jewish communal life. Yeah.
He had books listed beautifully. I think it was 1965. He expected the Pope expected.
Yes. Let him come to see me. That is quite right. He had a really good grasp of how to handle Jewish communal life. Very important in the early state of Israel, as we're going to see. He is the second Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel, and he continues to be an influence today in his approach and more in specific rulings that he issued. I have to thank Rav Tabori at the Gush. He has a 30-minute shiur online, which gave me some ideas for directions to go with this. A little bit of biography to start us off, so we'll know who it is that we're talking about here. So, Rav Isser Yehuda Unterman was born in Brisk in 1886. He was a child Iwui. He was known as an outstanding scholar as a kid. He learned in various yeshivot. He learned in Volozhin. It was Volozhin 2.0, right? Because Volozhin was closed by the Nitziv at the end of the 19th century, but then it was reopened several years later by Rav Rafael Shapiro. In 1899, Rav Shapiro reopened, and he studied under Rav Rafael Shapiro. He studied in the Mir, but he was very young when he did so, and as a result, he wasn't allowed into the big shir. So what would happen is he describes all of this in his introduction to Shevet Miyehuda, which is the name he gives to his halachic works. He talks about how he would learn Torah as a klisheni, meaning that the older students would hear the shir and then they would repeat it to him, and that was the way that he learned what had gone on in the shir. He also studied under Shimon Shkop, who is often described as being a great influence on his style of learning and his approach. He opened the yeshiva in Vishnieva. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, but he found he had throat problems from giving shir too often, and as a result, he retired from the Rosh Yeshiva business and instead became a communal Rav in various communities in Lithuania starting in 1910. So he was 24 years old at the time and running until the year 1924. He formed yeshivot in each community where he settled. Each yeshiva was called the Shevet Miyehuda, the scepter of Judah, his name being Isser Yehuda. In 1924, he became the chief rabbi of Liverpool. Now, young man from Brisk, right, becomes chief rabbi in Liverpool. What does he have to learn?
English.
That's right. He needs to learn English. So he masters English, and he becomes a leader in Liverpool. He unifies various congregations there. And even as many Liverpudlians fled during the air raids in World War II, Rav Unterman remained, and he took care of his own population from the community, as well as the Jews who were fleeing there as refugees. He was also a major figure in the Zionist movement there. He was the head of Mizrahi, and we're going to come back to his Zionism in a bit. But his Zionism is most immediately relevant as you talk about his biography, because in 1946 he makes Aliyah. He becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. In the 1950s, he joins the Chief Rabbinate Council, the body of rabbis who serve as advisors to the chief rabbi. And in 1964, he is appointed to fill the seat of Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, who had passed away. Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog was the first rabbi, first chief Ashkenazi chief rabbi after the founding of the state. And and when he passed away, Rav Unterman was appointed to take his place. When you look at the pictures of Rav Unterman, anyone here ever see a picture of Rav Unterman? So he has this great beard, but he also has a top hat. He continued to wear the top hat, which I assume he had worn in England.
And that they would surely was associated with Liverpool. I was born in Liverpool, by the way.
Really? I was wondering.
Your
accent doesn't sound as strong as Liverpool.
Well, because I spent 45 years in Canada. But,
got it.
So I know a lot about the Liverpool Jewish community. I thought the name was familiar.
There you go.
But I thought it was Rabbi Tov's Rebbe. Who's Rabbi Tov's Rebbe?
I don't know. I don't know which rule it was. I wish I had paid attention.
Because there are four major Orthodox shuls.
Yeah.
Prince's Road is a Victorian shul that was in the heart of Jewish community in the late 1800s. Late 1800s. But it became the Jewish community moved out. They moved out to a place called Chilwell, which is very interesting because the Labour Party was just overthrown in all major cities because of the anti-Semitism, which was very public. And they particularly mentioned four ridings, one being Barnet, the other being Chilwell. They were saying because it's just a large enough Jewish population that they were really upset by anti-Semitism. Anyhow, so Chilwell now had three shuls, and it would be very interesting.
Yeah, it's easy enough to find out. It's Googleable. You know, the information is there. I just didn't pay attention to it. Okay. So he continues to wear the top hat. Rav Herzog before him also did, but keep in mind, Rav Herzog was also from the UK. Rav Herzog was in Ireland, I believe.
They were canonicals, actually. The chief rabbi of England.
Yeah.
There's only one word to describe it. They look like
ropes.
They look like vicars, because they wore cloaks and special collars and special hats.
So in his picture, he doesn't have the special collars.
He doesn't have canonicals, but the top hat was normally worn by the president or the shul or the secretary, the wardens. And it would have been the old-fashioned shul. So Prince's Road, which is this Victorian shul, protected building now by. Anybody in there would have worn a top hat.
Yeah.
So he was wearing the top hat in Israel.
Yes, he wore a top hat in Israel, and that tradition of wearing the top hat stops with Rav Shlomo Gorin, who ends up replacing him. Rav Gorin is best known for his pictures in an IDF uniform as chief rabbi of the IDF, but Rav Gorin would not be seen in a top hat. Just knowing Rav Gorin's story, that just would not happen. So Rav Unterman serves in this capacity from 1964 until the conclusion of his term in 1972. He actually stands for re-election, but Rav Gorin is elected over the incumbent, and that was the whole story with the brother and sister, the Langers, and the Mamzerus issue. And Rav Unterman sided with those who considered them to be Mamzerim, leading some to suspect that the electorate for this position had been rigged, because you were elected chief rabbi by a certain body. It wasn't a national election. There were specific voters, and there were suggestions at the time that the population of the voters had been shifted in order to favor the election of somebody who would free up the Langers to get married. It's a story in its own right, not for right now. But after he finished being chief rabbi, he ran his own kollel, which of course was named Shevet Miyahuda. And he passed away in 1976 in Yerushalayim. But let's talk about, that's his biography, but let's talk about his platform. He was a moderate voice. He was an expert posig, really an expert in many areas of halacha, as we'll see. And he was very sensitive to the different parts of Israeli society and to the needs of individuals. And here I bring you my first source on the sheets. I love this tshuva. This is a great tshuva. The question that he's asked here, Shevet Miyahuda, which is the name given to his halachic work, posthumously they've published other writings of his that are not halachic under the name Shevet Miyahuda as well. But the Shevet Miyahuda, which was published in his lifetime, was of what he calls chikrei halacha on the front page, which means halachic analyses. They deal on practical issues, but they're long, long, long essays. So a big chunk, for example, of his first volume is on he calls issues of pikuach nefesh, issues of saving lives, and intricate halachic analyses. Volume 2 that's been published is a collection of his tshuvot, a collection of his responsa. And it's published posthumously, but it's such a good read. And the truth of the matter is, I hadn't really read it until preparing this. His first volume I've read in many circumstances because it comes up a lot in medical halacha discussion. His second volume I was really not familiar with, and it's such a fun read. So his tshuva here, his response here, number one. He was asked the question by a Jewish community. They had two bar mitzvah boys for the same Shabbos. Both boys want to lay in the Parsha and the Haftorah. What should we do?
In Europe?
No, this is in Israel. He's already chief. Well, I don't know where the question came from, but he was already chief rabbi. I didn't check to see where it came from. But what do you do with these boys who both want to lay? So if you were to ask the question today in most shuls, either you would say, well, there's a minion, there's a main shul minion, and then there's another minion, so one of them but one minion, one of the other minion. Or split the parsha, and that's just the way it goes. One gets to do the first four aliyos, one gets to do the latter three in the Haftarah, and that's the way it works. That's not his answer. And he gives you his answer, and he gives you the reasoning behind his answer, and it's beautiful. Take a look at number one. Laniyos Daiti, he says, in my humble opinion, insert English accent here, Ha'etza hi tova hi lasot kedi lahalan. Here's what I think the best idea is. Lefnesha echad korei lemaftir ba'Torah, before one of them reads the maftir, Yetzu asara anashim im ha'bar mitzvah ha'sheni l'cheder achir. I'm sorry, it wasn't about laying the parsha, it was just about laying the haftorah. That's what it was. So before one of them reads the maftir, let 10 go out with the bar mitzvah boy, the second bar mitzvah boy, to another room, l'cheder achir. Not to lay, just to go outside. After the first one finishes laning, Ubinavi, and the Haftorah, he does the Maftir, he does the Haftorah, Yikan Suha Anashimim Hasheni, then let those 10 men come back into Shul with the second bar mitzvah boy, then he can lane with all of the brachos. So in other words, the whole Shul is going to hear Maftir Haftorah twice. The kid went out with a minion. That minion still needs to hear Maftir Haftorah. So they'll come back in and everybody else will wait. Now, you'll tell me, why doesn't a rabbi do this nowadays? That's a concise way to put it. It's only called Tircha Detzibura. You're imposing on the entire community. They have to sit there and hear the Maftir and the Haftorah twice so that this kid can have his bar mitzvah celebration. Really? Are you serious? So he continues. After halachic discussion about the propriety of this solution, he says, "Ube'etzim ha'inyan, regarding this matter at its core, ra'oi lahadgish, it's appropriate to emphasize, ki mechuyavim lihishtadel lahafis es da'atam shel hatzirim hanichnasim la'ol mitzvos ve'es karoveihem. You have to appease the mind of, you have to satisfy the mind of these kids who are becoming bar mitzvah and their relatives. So that they will be drawn close to Torah and mitzvos. He says the opportunity for a kid to read in front of the entire community, not in the side minion, but to read in the main shul, that makes an impression on him. Matbiya benafsho rachshei kodesh. It imprints upon his soul holy feelings. Hamashbiim letova gama kol ele shebo lichvodo, which will have a good influence not only on him, but on everybody who comes for his celebration. Afal pi sheinim regilim lavo lebeis hakneses, the people who come in, who don't necessarily go to shul all the time, but they're there for the bar mitzvah. He says it's clear that his reading, which comes after an extended preparation period, is a real spiritual experience. He says, don't mock such things. Don't take it lightly. If it isn't going to violate a halacha, if it's not going to violate a minhag, that's what you do. And he says, by the way, given this importance, he says, that means the gabbai have to be careful to keep people from talking during the laning. Not just laning in general, but the bar mitzvah boys laning. because you ruin the whole impression of the glory of the moment for the bar mitzvah boy. The spirit of holiness disappears, and you ruin what's going on if you have talking. And he goes on in that vein for a while, but it's a beautiful sensitivity that he has to the bar mitzvah boys, and he's willing to put the tzibur through hearing the maftir and haftarah twice for the sake of them having their moment in the sun. I thought that was a very good read of the situation. He was also an international voice in terms of his scholarship. He was renowned for his knowledge. His response, and again, I don't remember where the bar mitzvah one went, but his response in general go to communities all around the world. His first volume of Shevet Me'ehuda, the one that does all the halachic analyses, won the Rav Kook Prize for Torah Literature in 1954. The editor of Shevet Me'ehuda, in his introduction, quotes Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Deish, with great praise of Rav Unterman. And he was also an activist. In 1964, he toured the United States to raise money for, and here I was going to look it up to see what this was. It said Keren HaHalvaot, or Agudat HaHalvaot, which sounds like Israel Bonds, the organization of loans. He raised millions of dollars in 1964, and to meet Jewish communities. He met with former United States President Harry Truman in Kansas City on his tour. He was an activist for Soviet Jewry. In 1967, he wrote a tefillah to be recited on their behalf in shuls before shofar blowing on Rosh Hashanah and before Mariv on Yom Kippur. One of his most controversial leniencies, we're going to come back to it, was to accept the conversions of non-Jewish Russians who had married Jews and made aliyah. Even though their Jewish spouses were not practicing Judaism, he argued, as we'll see, to accept their conversions. When he was already chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he strongly supported establishing the 10th of Teves as Yom HaKadish HaKlali, the Universal Day of Kaddish, right? An international day of memorial for victims of the Holocaust, which may be why England is really, I think, the main place in the world, maybe in Israel also, where that day is actually observed that way, meaning I remember having the volumes of Slichos that came out of England in my shul in Pennsylvania, and there they had special Slichos to say on Asar B'Teves, marking it as a day to remember the Holocaust. But I did not see that in the U.S. growing up, that people observed the day that way. That was his position. If you take a look at source number 2, this is from his declaration dedicating the day. He says, Achshav kavanu yom zikaron tmidi l'churban zeh. Now we have established a day of permanent memorial for this, or ongoing memorial, I should say, for this destruction. Hu yom asar b'teves yom tanis tzibur l'doros. The 10th of Teves, a fast day for all generations. Hatzom the day that the fast day on which the first destruction began, that should also be Memorial Day for the last destruction, at the end of the last exile. And he continues to say, he says, we should rise above the matters of the moment and unify ourselves in remembering our martyrs, Shinisharu Ne'amanim L'Netzach Yisrael, who remain loyal to God, Msurim L'Chazon HaGeula Ad HaRega HaAcharon, given to the vision of redemption until the last moment. And he goes on to talk about how they died singing Ani Mamin, and how their memory must remain inscribed on the hearts of all Jews and must never be erased. So he played this role internationally in terms of his activism. There's more to say about his activism, but there's so much that I want to talk about here. I wanted to come back to Zionism for a moment. He was, as we said, a staunch Zionist in England. After the state was founded, he ruled that Hallel should be recited on Yom HaAtzma'ut, no bracha, but with a bracha on Yom Yerushalayim. He had a very interesting tshuva that he wrote in 1954 regarding music on Yom HaAtzma'ut. Take a look at source number 3. He says, Harabanim hitiru b'mefarash tizmoret bayom ha'u. He says the rabbis have, and keep in mind, he says it's 1954. He's not the chief rabbi yet. He says the rabbis have explicitly permitted music on that day. Mipnei hatshu'ah hagedolah shevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu al Yisrael, because of the great redemption, the great salvation that God brought upon Israel. Shakama medinat Yisrael atzma'it, the rise of an independent Jewish state. Bli ol zarim b'shibud l'umah acheret, without the yoke of foreigners, without being bound to any other nation. V'niftechu sha'arei eretz Yisrael l'revacha lifnei hamon beis Yisrael v'chol artzos pizurav. The gates of Israel are opened wide for the masses of Israel to come from all the lands where they are scattered. And al yedei zeh, because of this, alu yosem mishishim ribo nefesh min hagoluyos, more than 600,000 Jews have ascended from exile. V'zoi lefi emunaseinu aschalta digeulich. Same emunaseinu, that's a typo of my own. According to our faith, that is atchalta de geula, the beginning of the redemption. And then he addresses people who say, but what about the fact that it's led by secular Jews and so much of the country is secular? Ve'im ki amatzav ruchani lo masbi'a ratzon klal. He says, yeah, we're not happy at all. We're not satisfied at all with the spiritual state of affairs. And we need to fight perpetually to strengthen the religion and to guard the Torah and its mitzvos. He says, look, read your Tanakh. In the beginning of the days of Ezra, right, and before Ezra, the beginning of the second base Hamikdash, when Zerubbabel came, he says, that's the same situation. You had intermarriages, problems with Shabbos observance, and so on. Ve'emunaseinu takifa, ki matzav yishtaper. He says, we believe strongly that the situation will improve. Ve'am Yisrael yashuv l'derech hayadus ha'ne'amana, and the nation of Israel will return to the way of loyal Judaism. And here's the funny part. I mean, the whole thing is a great tshuva, but here's the part that that people find particularly interesting. Kan anu smechem b'tshuas Hashem. Here we rejoice in the salvation of God in Tel Aviv. B'shir urinana v'halo b'tzibur b'li bracha. He says we sing, we say halo communally without a bracha. Gam b'ir b'nei brak. And he says also in b'nei brak. Asharov ha'machriach shal yoshveh shomrei Torah mitzvos, where the great majority of the residents keep Torah and mitzvah. Sider Rosh Ha'ir Rav Yitzchak Gershtakorin Hashem Yishmer V'atzileyu, the mayor of the city, the head of the city, Rabbi Yitzchak Gershtakorin, has arranged Tizmoret Ba'ir B'Yom Ha'atzma'ut, the playing of music in the city in Bnei Brak on Yom Ha'atzma'ut, U'mitzvah L'sameach B'Yom Zeh U'Lahalel Hashem Al Chasadav. It is a mitzvah to rejoice on this day and to praise Hashem, thank Hashem for His kindness. That was the position of Rav Unterman, and he reports that that was what was done in Bnei Brak in 1954. The reason why it's startling is because Bnei Brak was a very strong yeshivish community back then. That was where the Chazon Ish was. That was the Chazon Ish's stronghold. But he says public music. I don't know the position of the Chazon Ish on it. After the reunification of Yerushalayim in 1967, Rav Unterman sided with the view that said not to change Nachem. That was the big fight. Rav Gorin wanted to change Nachem. Rav Unterman sided with those who said no. Even though he calls this Aschalta de Geula, he says, so we have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't change the text. Okay. So that's some background on his platform. Right? We see his activism, we see his international role, we see his sensitivity, we see his Zionism. But the main part of what grabs me about Rav Unterman is his concern as a chief rabbi for the halachic health of the community. Meaning his psak is shaped not only by where he thinks the halacha lies, but also on the needs of the community who's going to have to follow it. And we'll see that in a few different ways. And I gave various examples. We may not end up reading all of them inside. We'll see how much we get through in the text. But number one, he's very concerned about straining the community's allegiance to halacha. He doesn't want a situation in which people are pushed to the extent that they're not going to follow it. So the introduction to his tshuvas, to his responsa, has quotes from Buntman on the importance of this, and one particular one they reference, it's Ibn Ezra Yud Aleph. So I went looking at the whole tshuva. Well, take a look at it, you'll see. He's talking about the issue of permitting a woman to her husband. Is the case whether a woman who had been involved in an affair was allowed to be with her husband afterwards. It's not quite an affair, it's a shomer, it's the Yavam case. We don't need to go through the specifics right now, but take a look at what he writes. He gives you a basis for his conclusion by an analogy to another case, and he says the truth of the matter is the case I'm using as my template is not really analogous to what I'm saying. Becholzen, nonetheless, ani no tela hakel, I'm inclined to be lenient. Ki sadru la chupa v'kiddushin kishiyat starfu elai od shnei dayanim uvhakim. He says, if I can get two other expert judges to agree with me, then I would arrange a chupa for her. Ubismaneinu, but here's the key. In our day, drushim li'ikar kocha dehetera be'inyin kazeh, we need the kocha de hetera, the power of leniency for a case like this. Lest people be drawn further and further away from Judaism. Thankfully, so it appears in my humble opinion. He's very sensitive to the fact that he doesn't want to push the community too far. So here's a great example of it in source number 5. Fellow writes to a Bunterman, and again, I don't know where this is from, but it was somewhere in Israel, this case. Fellow name of Mar Jacobson writes to a Bunterman, upset because the local kindergarten has bunny rabbits for the kids. What's wrong with having bunny rabbits in the kindergarten? They're not kosher animals. So what? So there's a Lubavitch idea that you don't want to have books with non-kosher, pictures of non-kosher creatures and all. You don't want, there's somehow something about the kids being drawn into this. But the person who's writing seems to be concerned with something that to me is counterintuitive. That if the kids are exposed to bunny rabbits like this, then when they grow up, they might eat rabbit. I would have thought the opposite. Generally speaking, when kids get close to a creature, that makes them less likely to want to eat it, not more. But that's the concern of this fellow, Mar Jacobson, who writes to Rav Unterman. Rav Unterman doesn't call him on the logic of it, but he says to him, I'm sorry, we don't need to invent halachic problems. He says, Barur HaDavar, source number 5, it's clear. Ki kavanaso shamar Jacobson, he ritsuya. He borrows the language of the Kuzari. He says, your intent, I get, your intent is desirable to God. I see, Mar Jacobson is really upset when he sees kids playing with a non-kosher animal. Aval hu hifriz al hamida, but he has gone beyond what is appropriate. When he makes the argument that this is going to weaken their recoil from Tumah. When he says that this could cause the kids, God forbid, to eat rabbit. He says, Chashash zeh bo lo kenir'eh mipnesh of balo. We should say, not bolo. Balo. No typo. All this I had to retype. The PDF is not good for cutting and pasting. He says, Chashash zeh bo lo kenir'eh mipnesh ha'isa tkufa shal gidul shfanim b'kibbutzim chavshiyim. He says, you know why he had this concern? Because this was a time when they were growing, they were raising rabbits on kibbutzim that didn't observe halacha. There was an issue of not making your living out of raising and selling non-kosher animals. So they were raising rabbits there, presumably for their meat. Brahm, Einani, don't do my claw, but he says, you can't compare that with a kindergarten. And he says, he says, you can't go beyond the bounds of the law, because every time you add astringency, you are actually reducing the effectiveness of halacha. That's the position of Rav Unterman. On an issue of greater import, right? I mean, not that the rabbits in the kindergarten aren't important, but on an issue that I think would be more personal for people, the discussion of conversion of the spouses of Russian Jews, you see the same mentality in source number 6. And here, I'm glad I did not need to retype it, because I found that someone had put it on a website, and I was able to cut and paste it, rather than having to retype all of this. But I only brought you a piece. There's a lot more here, but it's very instructive. He says, Bimiyuchad, especially when he's talking about being lenient on these conversions that are going on in the state of Israel, Ela sheba'im me'Rusya, b'mishpachos me'uravos, people who come from Russia with mixed marriages, l'dati ein l'hachmir aleihem b'she'elos kashos, I don't think we should be very strict with them and ask them hard questions, b'vnei sh'nir aleihem ki'ilu anachnu mitgarim b'hem, because they assume, they think, that we are giving them a hard time. Uvdahi, Shehem rotzim b'emes l'hisgayer. He says they want to convert. Their desire is sincere. They want to be Jewish. Vizet barulanu mishtepanim. And he says there are two reasons to say that. Mitzad mehatzad achad, from the first point, hare lo kal tu klalas yisadot hadat hanotzrit. Mebesh lo lomdim sham dat b'derach klal. He says, first of all, they're coming from Russia. It's not like they've absorbed Christianity there. Right? Because they don't teach Christianity in communist Russia. Certainly when they're young, who grew up in, under communism, they don't have any exposure to that at all. And similarly, he says they're sick of what they're hearing of the denial of God that they hear, which is force fed to the young to the point where they vomit. And when we explain to them the principles of our holy religion, Zeu etzlam kidin kidio, it should say, Katsuv on the Erchadash, Sheino nimchak maer. It's like ink written on fresh paper for them. It won't be erased quickly. Umitzad Sheini, that's his first point. His first point is they're very open to Judaism because of their experience under communism. They didn't fall in love with Christianity. They're sick of being told there's no God. They're open. And second, he says, Habayim misham lakan mleim rirut neged haradifot al yudim hashim tzot shalem al adat shalanu. He says the people who come from Russia are angry about the persecution of Jews that happens over there. V'gam libam mar ma'od neged yidideim v'chavereim hagoyim. They're very upset at their friends who aren't Jewish. Shalom du lagin aleihem u'bagdu b'ididutam, who didn't protect them, but instead betrayed their friendship. Meaning, these are people who either are born to families in which the father was Jewish, the mother was not, and they were abused by all the other Russians, right? Because the anti-Semites don't really care whether it's matrilineal or patrilineal descent, or they were married to Jews who suffered because of the persecution. Mishum kach, therefore, kishanu mekablim osam be'ahada. So when we accept them with respect, miskashrim heim b'leiv shalem im ha'am ha'yehudi, they form a full bond, a sincere bond with the Jewish nation. V'gamim etzem ha'yisodot shel dat kachenu, and with the basic principles of our holy religion, shmir Shabbos kodesh, kosher uchdom. V'im heim orim b'fem alei, and if they say with a full mouth, and if they say after they have accepted, they've heard and accepted some of the easier mitzvahs, some of the more severe mitzvahs, when they say we accept, we're going to guard this, we're going to keep this, Zoe Kabbalah Nechona. That is a full and proper acceptance of Judaism. Ba'achrei tevila, hein Yehudim. They are Jewish once they've immersed. Ein eifo makom lachashashanut yisera shetigrom chas v'shalom l'rachik osam v'alidei kach l'rachik es ha'mishpacha kula. He says there's no room for excessive suspicion, which is going to distance them and their entire family. And even if you see that they have some ulterior motive for converting, this does not counteract their essential acceptance of Judaism. You should convert them right away, not make them wait. And he quotes you the language of halacha, we immerse them and we convert them right away once they accept, and we do not delay this mitzvah. And then he goes on the flip side of the sheet, I'll summarize it in the interests of time, but he goes on to say that these people are for sure going to accept Judaism after a while, and they will embrace it. They'll know about our history and so on. He says, absolutely, these people are going to be full proper Jews.
It's also, we say Christians, it means different here than in Russia, because here is Protestants and here there is Russian Orthodox, which doesn't believe in the 25th and all the other things.
Right, they do have certain differences, it's true. They follow Pesach to determine when Easter is, for starters. This is true. In another example I brought you in source number 7, we don't need to read it inside, I don't think it adds that much, but I wanted you to have access to some of the text. He was asked by Bar Ilan University whether they could do research using cells from aborted fetuses. Now, we're about to see in a moment that he was very, very strong against abortion. One of Rav Unterman's hallmark positions was that he felt, as you'll see, that abortion is never. It's allowed to save the life of the mother. But beyond that, he was a hardliner on abortion. Nonetheless, he told Bar Ilan University in source number 7 that they would be allowed to do research using the cells from embryos that have been aborted. Now, it's a very interesting tshuva. I didn't bring enough of it, really, but I wanted to fit everything on one page here. But he does something very interesting here. The letter is written to him with a request that he answer next day. Letter comes in late at night, and they want an answer from him the next day. That's what he writes in his response. He says, since you asked for a response the next day, I'm rushing to answer you. However, I have a number of problems with what you've written to me, which I don't have space for right here. So what I'm going to tell you is, you're allowed to do this. I see that you've consulted with great Rabbanim and they've permitted. I agree with them to permit, but you should know I have a lot of objections to what you wrote and to the logic and whatever. So he's going to give them the heter, but he does have issues with it, and he has issues with it because of his stance on abortion. And this is something that I want to stress here, because you find, unfortunately, that some Rabbanim who are sensitive to the needs of the community and don't want to be too strict will go to the opposite end of the spectrum and they'll permit everything. And it's only a question of how are they going to get there. That's not who he is. It's a principled leniency. And when he believes that it's wrong, when he believes that something is usser, and sorry, that's the way it is, he's willing to take that stand even when he knows that he is in the minority. And that was the case in the issue of abortion. He writes at length regarding abortion in terms of his opposition. I gave you a quote here in source number 8. The quote that I gave you is actually from the Sri Deyesha's summary of the issue, because I couldn't find a single line that I wanted to pull out from him on it. So what I brought you instead was from Yevchiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Deyesh, who was a prominent halachic authority during the war. He was in Berlin during the Holocaust, and then afterwards he went to Switzerland. And he had a yeshiva in Switzerland. And Rav Weinberg had taken a lenient stance on abortion. Take a look at what he then writes. He says, Kevin Shirov HaRishonim Chokim al HaRambam. Since most of the early authorities disagree with the Rambam in terms of the discussion about whether abortion is like murder or not, and when it's prohibited, you could be lenient and rely on the Shelis Yavetz, who had a remarkable leniency regarding abortion. But then he says, then I saw the sixth volume of the journal Noam. Shagon Rav Yehuda Unterman, Rav HaRashi Beretz Yisrael Shlita, Oser Es Hapalas HaUbar BeIshacholanit Afilu Kodem Mem Yom. He prohibited abortion even if the mother is ill, not deathly ill, but even if she's ill, even before the 40-day mark. So he says, I back down. I have to back down on this because Rav Unterman is who he is, and therefore I think you need to go back for other opinions from leading authorities. I'm not willing to be the lenient voice. Also in Shevet Me'Yehuda and Aruch Chaim Lamed Daled, he has a tshuva against microphones in shuls on Shabbos and Yom Tov, so he knew how to say asur. But where possible, he absolutely wanted to permit. So that's one of the values that he brings to the table, is the sensitivity to the needs of the community. I realize that I'm racing. If you have to, you know, if you have a question, you want to interrupt me, please do. Another of his concerns that really presents him as a chief rabbi was his concern for communal unity. This is all part of the discussion of the halachic health of the community. He wanted everybody to be doing the same thing where possible. He felt it would be damaging to break Jews into groups. And you see that in terms of his emphasis in his declaration for Yom HaKadish HaKali, the 10th of Teves. He wants everybody to put their differences aside. But also, on a much more mundane matter, the issue of whether swordfish is kosher, the swordfish discussion. Rav Moshe David Tendler did a lot of work on the issue of which scales on fish constitute scales and which scales do not constitute scales. If the fish has fins and scales, it's considered a kosher fish. But what is a scale? There are fish that have scales that are only there when they're in their youth and then they drop off. There are scales that are hard and fixed. There are scales that are there until they come out of the water and then the scales fall off. So there's a whole debate surrounding the swordfish. Rav Moshe David Tendler said swordfish is not kosher. The sources that people use to claim that swordfish is kosher actually refer to the sailfish, not to the swordfish. So argued Rav Tendler. Rav Unterman disagreed. Rav Unterman said that's not true. He said swordfish is a kosher fish. The conservative movement in North America, I think, thinks that swordfish is kosher. So Rav Unterman, take a look at this, number 11. This is an excerpt from his tshuva on it. I brought two lines from it. The first line because it's amusing, and then the second line because it relates to our point here. Nosaf lekach. This first sentence has many words in it that are not Hebrew. Nosaf lekach. In addition to the points he's already made, ra'inu be. What does that say? Next word. Britannica.
Encyclopedia
Britannica. He's a good Liverpudlian. The Nosaf Lekach, what am I going to consult? Ra'inu b'Encyclopedia Britannica, ki swordfish, yes, that's how you write it, shayach l'mishpachat ha, who can do that one? What? Yes, the mackerel family, that's right. He says, Encyclopedia Britannica says that swordfish is of the mackerel family, shem dagim taharim, and mackerel is a kosher fish. So that's just amusing. But the next line, Uklal gadol etzleinu, and we have a general rule. Ki ov tahor ne'achal b'mesores gam kishein lo simanei kashrus. He says a kosher fish. Oh, you know what? I jumped. I'm sorry. I jumped past where I wanted to be. That swordfish piece 11 is about the swordfish, but it's not the one I wanted. 9 is the one I wanted. I jumped down. Hold the thought on number 11 about the kosher birds. Number 9 is the part of it that I wanted right now. V'im kifisha anu mekavim. This is the end of his letter to Rabbi Tendler. After making all the points about the kashrus of swordfish, he says, if, as we hope, yimsa, he, Rabbi Tendler, will find, sheyesh l'smoch al divrei haposkim, that you can rely on the halachic authorities I've cited, yo'il na lefarsem et zeh. I hope that he will actually go out and publicize it. L'to'elas beis Yisrael hazehirim b'yisurim. For the benefit of the Jewish people who are careful about prohibitions, v'gam kidei shelo yiyu agudot agudot, and so that they won't be broken up into groups. Eilu osim ve'ilu matirin. Some are going to prohibit, some are going to permit. He says, it's not enough that you agree with me that this is permitted. You have to tell people it's permitted. We can't have a situation in which some Jews think that this is not kosher while other Jews are eating it. If I'm right that it's kosher, tell the world. Make sure that everybody will do this. He's very concerned about communal unity. However, despite his concern for communal unity, his view of communal health is such that communities have to be able to honor their own practices. And yes, if you're bothered by that this is a little bit in contradiction, you're right. It requires a balancing, and it's really very situation dependent. So, for example, he has a tshuva. He did not end up bringing this on the sheet. He was approached regarding wine. The question was, does pasteurization count as bishul, as cooking wine, such as the wine will be called yayin mevushal. You won't have an issue of stam yenam, right? We know that we need to heat the wine to a certain temperature. Will pasteurization work? And there are various questions that arise in this conversation. Is any wine actually lost when you do the pasteurization? Is it a flash pasteurization, or is it something enduring? Is there any evaporation? Is the first point. The second is the length of time. What's the temperature to which it's heated? So it's actually really interesting. The question that he's asked has multiple parts, but at one point the person who's writing the question to him just asks him, is the mevushal wine of such and such a winery kosher? And he begins his response by saying, you know, that's not the way you write a question. The way you write a question, benoha gislena, what our practice is, you actually spell out the different sides that you see, and then there's a discussion, and the posek answers your question. You just wrote one sentence of, is this wine kosher? That's not the way we write questions. But then he goes on to answer him anyway, after this bit of rebuke. And he says to him, in his letters, he emphasizes that each community should do its own thing. Meaning, there are communities where the standard is that we do not accept pasteurization, and they should continue not to use it. There are communities where they do accept it, they should not use this wine. And I don't really know why it is that he's okay with that for the pasteurization, but he's not okay with that for the swordfish. Like, why can't there be a halachic argument regarding the swordfish also? Swordfish, he wants everybody to know it's mutter. The wine? No such consideration. It's not clear to me why, except I think the reason may be, based on the tshuva we're about to read, that it's because the positions that were taken on yayin mevushal and what constitutes bishul, what constitutes cooking the wine, were already entrenched. It was an application question. In other words, these communities already say pasteurization counts. These communities say pasteurization does not count. And the only question is, apply it to this particular circumstance, as opposed to the swordfish, where we're debating what the status is of these scales. And the reason I say that is because of what he has here in number 10, which I thought was fascinating. As a Liverpudlian, I'll ask you the question. When kids learned in school there, did they learn Hebrew with a Sephardic accent or Ashkenazi? Ashkenazi. Okay, take a look at this. Source number 10. He was asked the question in Israel regarding what to do in a shul where the original accent that was used was Ashkenazi, but kids are growing up learning in Mivtah Sfaradit, and they want to do their learning for the bar mitzvah in Sfaradit. What should we do? See, he says, so the writer, the person who wrote to him, wants to say, shut them down, Ashkenazi through and through. And he says, Kol zeh nachon, all the points you've made are correct. V'tasi li shegam ani pasakti kein be'ir Liverpool. He says, when I lived in Liverpool, that was my psak as well. That in fact, the shul has a minhag, you stick to the shul's minhag. Kishabo anashim tzirim beis kinesis ba'achad parvarim. When people came, young people came from some shul in one of the neighborhoods. V'ta'anu ki mikevan sheyeladim shalahem mekablim shiurim mimoreh sheba me'eretz Yisrael. And they said, our kids are learning from a rabbi who came from Israel. V'hum argilo sam likro lispalil v'lumod b'havaras fardit. And he is accustoming them to daven and to learn in the Sephardi accent. So they want the leaning to be like that also. That the kids will understand what they're reading. Or maybe I should do it in Ashkenazi, right? He says, I opposed it strongly. He says, you can't force people to accept a new way of doing things against their tradition. It should say kach. Even if the people who want it are the majority, you still don't do it. That was his position in Liverpool. But he changes his mind in Israel. Barum, however, Ein mizeh kol raya l'nidon shelefaneinu. He says there's no proof of that from that to our case. Ki erkev hatzibur shelanu nishtana tachlis shinui me'az shnechtevu advarim. He says because the makeup of our community has changed greatly. From the time when this was originally discussed in 1945, ad yameinu eila, to our day. Beinatayim, in between 1945 and now, nitosvu meot alafim achim. hundreds of thousands of our brothers have come to Israel. Shaloshamu havara acheret el ha-Sfaradit, and they only know Sfaradi. Kamochin galu shnei dorot shechunchu rak al pi havara Sfaradit. Two generations have grown up in this land learning only Sfaradit. Tzibur zem orav kol beit knesset. They're mixed into every shul. Ve'ech afshar lishlo mehem et hazuchut lekro b'havara shegudlu v'chunchu ba. How can you deprive them of the right to read in the accent that they were raised with, they were educated in? V'lachein ein limnoa yeladim milikro b'tora b'havara sfardit b'shum makom. So he says, don't prevent them anywhere from using havara sfardit. Ein in... I think it might be ach, I'm not sure. Im yidrishu likboa takana likro tamid b'havara sfaradit levad, but if they want to make a ruling that they should only use sfaradit, ein lishmo alehem, then don't listen to them. Don't change the minhag of the shul. Ki gadol koach ha-masoret shehur galu lazeh b'meshach dorot, he says the tradition that's been going on for generations that everyone's been accustomed to is powerful. Shafilu ma-miyut doresh l'bli l'shanot shomim lahem, even if it's only a minority that still wants to follow it, you listen to them. So he says, when I was in Liverpool, I said, stick to the minhag of the shul. But at a certain point, you have all these people who have been raised this way. It's a whole community. They came from other lands where they davened that way. Two generations have been educated this way. It's silly to deny that this, at this point, is a legitimate alternative practice. And I think, again, that may be what he's doing with the Mavushal wine. It's an entrenched view that pasteurization counts or doesn't count. The only question is the application. As opposed to the swordfish discussion, which is being hashed out now, and he wants it to be and he wants there to be unity. I think that's the difference.
It's interesting, but in Beit, I was a rabbi in the Ashkelon community for a number of years, and this was under Rabbi Tope, and there were many, we had to go get a somebody's lane every week, and some of them did it in Ashkenaz, some of them in Sephardic.
Yeah.
He insisted in the Parshas Deraisa, that it had to be Ashkenazic.
Right, so I've heard about that. The last point in terms of his style of as a chief rabbi, right? I'm emphasizing as a chief rabbi the sensitivity to the community's needs and the fact he doesn't want to push them too far. The concern for communal unity, while on the other hand wanting communities to be able to honor their own established practices. The last piece that I wanted to bring in under this heading is what I called on the sheet Maaseh Rav. He believes in the power of tradition. So that this is the swordfish piece that I jumped to in number 11. After the Encyclopedia Britannica note, he says, "Uklal gadol etzleinu." We have a general rule. Ki ov tahor ne'achal b'masoret gam kishein lo simanei kashrut. If there's a tradition that everybody says this is a kosher bird, then even if you don't have the signs, there are certain signs about the eggs or the way that it splits its claws when it's standing on something, even if it doesn't have that, it's kosher. Ki amasoret ha'atikash nimsura midor dor al yedei Yehudim medakdikim b'torah u'mitzvot hi meshameshet hochacha birura u'maspeket she'efshar l'smoch aleha. He says, when you have an old tradition transmitted from generation to generation via Jews who were careful. It's not that, you know, you showed up in New Orleans and everybody's eating the Muscovy duck and therefore it must be kosher. That was what happened with Rav Illowy. He shows up in New Orleans and that's what they're doing. And he says, you can't tell me that that's a proof. The person who's selling it is also their chazen, and he also shechts on, he has his butcher shop open on Shabbos. That's not a guy I'm going to trust to tell me that there's a tradition that this is a kosher bird. But Rav Linderman says the swordfish was eaten by people who are careful in mitzvos. Yes, absolutely, it must be kosher. He had the same thing regarding elevators. In the early days of the elevator responsa for, you know, elevators for Shabbos. So one of the key points in debate was the question of your weight doing work for you. Your weight in the elevator is helping to move the elevator down. So therefore, you are doing malacha, even though you're not jumping up and down. You're just standing there. So he says, well, you know what? Gedolim, right, great figures, rode on ships. The proof from writing on shifts wasn't about the weight doing the work. It was about being on the thing that's actually working to move you along. The weight was a separate point. He said that he had seen great halachic authorities riding on elevators with people who are not Jewish. The person who's not Jewish will, you know, push you out the button, go to his floor, whatever it is. But he said, I saw great figures, I'm blanking now on who he quoted, but I think the Chafetz Chaim was one of them, having ridden in elevators with people who are not Jewish. So he says, they did it, that tells you this must be okay. So the idea that there's precedent, and that you honor precedent, is another major piece for him. Last part. Medical halacha. And here I'll be quick because we only have a couple of minutes. But Rav Unterman was a pioneer in the realm of medical halacha. His predecessor, Rav Herzog, also got involved. Rav Unterman more so, I believe. And he took positions that remain influential to this day. He issued remarkable rulings. For example, in source number 12, I brought you Rav Unterman as quoted by Rav Avadia Yosef, rather than go back to the original. He's dealing with the question of whether saving a patient's vision is the equivalent to saving their life. Is it like saving their life? And he says, regarding the person who is blind, he's distinguishing between somebody who is blind and somebody who has seizures. I take it back. Rav Avadia is the one who makes the distinction between the person who is blind and the person who's having seizures. But then Rav Avadia quotes Rav Unterman on the second line in source number 12. Umnam, in truth. Ra'isi l'Rav Unterman shlita shevet me'Yehuda. Sha'acha shechilek ben suma l'nichfa ka'amur. First he makes the distinction between the person who is blind and the person who has seizures. But then he writes the following. Shuv isbonanti ke'in l'chalek ben zel azeh. There's no difference between the two of those people. V'yesh sakana mamashit gam l'suma. The person who is blind faces real danger. And therefore saving him from blindness or healing his blindness is called saving a life. Why? Because you can't keep him in his house all the time. And I'm going to just translate it as we go because of time. He says if he travels in the street, he faces all sorts of danger lying in wait for him, and he has to go up and down steps. You can't avoid the danger, and therefore he says this is considered pikuach nefesh, saving someone's life. This is really important because it comes up in issues like cornea donations and transplants. He ruled, as I noted above, that a fetus is fully alive even in the earliest stages, and he prohibited heart transplants. We had the shiur several months ago on the artificial heart. So Rav Unterman believed that that taking out somebody's heart is killing them, and therefore he would not allow heart transplants. Right? We noted at the time that leads to a very odd position. Today, heart surgery is done. You stop the person's heart routinely as part of heart surgery. Are you going to tell me that you've now killed the patient? But Rav Unterman did not live to see those surgeries carried out, so we don't know what he would have said. His approach in general to medical halacha, seen at length in volume 1 of Shevet Me'Yehuda, is that he developed his ideas by analyzing the sugya, going back through the Gemara, asking tough questions and intricate discussions, and then applying it to the modern questions. And today, that's actually fairly standard as the approach of the leaders in medical halacha. That's the way they do it. But in his day, you didn't have many who were doing this. He could also be creative. And this I get to my last point, because I love this example. He could also be creative. He took the position that a transplanted organ becomes rejuvenated when it functions as part of the new body. And therefore, you're not concerned about issues of delaying burial, right, of the organ that came from somebody who was deceased. And you're not concerned with impurity for a kohen, because it comes back to life. It's not tamei, and it doesn't need burial. It's a remarkable position. I brought you a paragraph from it in source number 13, in which he says this. Yisoda heter hu ki besar hames asur rak kolz man shu mes. He said, you're not allowed to benefit from the flesh of a dead body only as long as it's dead. When it wakes up, now it's no longer usur. You're allowed to benefit from it. And he goes on to try to bring sources to support the idea from cases of Trias HaMesim that are found in Tanakh. He says, absolutely, you're allowed to benefit from it. The whole concern about Hana from a dead body about benefit from a dead body is a non-issue, he says. Now, that's actually an interesting discussion. Rosh Shlomo Zalman did not like that idea at all. He said, you still had a mitzvah of burial. How did you lose that mitzvah of burial? And Rav Herschel Schachter points out that it only works, this argument only works once the flesh is incorporated in the body. But until then, the Kohen is becoming tamei. Right, it's tummy until it actually grows new blood vessels and is brought back to life. So the argument is a dicey one and requires some discussion. But he was a major pioneer in the realm of medical halacha, and the statements he made, like that one, are relevant and followed to this day. Thank you very much. Next week, Rabbi Ziering continues, and hopefully without a basketball and hockey competition or an Amunah dinner, we'll get back.